From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet writers Scott Spencer and Martin Amis. They each have new novels about unsuccessful novelists, their literary rivalries, and midlife crises. The main character in Scott Spencer's book, Men in Black, is a writer who churns out schlock books under a pen name because his own novels don't sell. The main character in Martin Amis's The Information also writes novels that don't sell. In fact, he can't even get some of them published. But nothing upsets him more than the literary success of his best friend. Also today, what's good grammar for a Cosmo girl? Linguist Jeff Nunberg has some thoughts on the magazine's latest grammar quiz. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Attorney General Janet Reno says two men detained today by the FBI are cooperating in the Oklahoma City bombing probe. Gary Land and Robert Jacks were picked up this morning in Carthage, Missouri. They're expected to appear before a U.S. magistrate today. They're being called material witnesses and not suspects in this case. The United States has announced a plan to admit Cuban refugees now in holding camps at the U.S. naval base at Guantanamo Bay. UPI's Bill Small has this report.
In an apparent reversal of policy, the U.S. says it will now start admitting most of the 21,000 Cuban migrants being held in camps at the Guantanamo Bay naval base. Attorney General Janet Reno.
The number of these special Guantanamo entrants admitted to the United States will be credited against the 20,000 annual Cuban migration figure. Thus, there will be no net increase in Cuban migration.
Reno also says from now on, Cuban migrants picked up at sea will not be taken to Guantanamo Bay. They'll be taken back to Cuba. Bill Small at the White House.
The Senate Committee on Labor and Human Resources has opened hearings to consider the nomination of Dr. Henry Foster to be Surgeon General. NPR's Joe Palka reports.
In the 3 months since President Clinton chose Henry Foster to be his new Surgeon General, controversy has swirled around the nominee. The furor has largely been about abortion. At today's hearing, Foster sought to turn the focus back to what he would do as Surgeon General if he is confirmed by the Senate.
As Surgeon General, I will focus on a full range of health challenges facing this nation. These include cancer, HIV/AIDS, heart disease, mental disease, maternal and child health, mental health, aging, substance abuse, violence, and of course, the epidemic of teen pregnancies.
The hearing could conclude today, but more likely will spill over into a second day of hearings tomorrow. This is Joe Palka in Washington.
The Senate has voted to limit punitive damages and medical malpractice damage awards against doctors and other health care providers. The cap would be set at 2 times the amount calculated for lost salary and medical bills, as well as for pain and suffering. The Republicans had originally sought a cap of $250,000. The U.S. ambassador to Croatia says rocket attacks in the capital, Zagreb, are equal to a declaration of full-scale war. Ambassador Peter Galbraith says Serbian attacks on the Croatian capital are the most serious escalation of warfare since the Balkan conflict began. As many as 7 loud explosions were heard in Zagreb this morning. Reports say at least 5 people were killed and some 70 people were hurt. The Croatian fighting opened as a 4-month truce expired yesterday in Bosnia. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 8 points at 4,324. This is NPR. German authorities say they'll keep British trader Nick Leeson in jail while they review an extradition request for him from Singapore. NPR's Deidre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
Singapore filed a formal extradition request last week with German authorities. Singaporean officials charged the 28-year-old trader with 11 counts of forgery and deceptive business practices. Leeson, who was the chief trader for Barings Bank in Singapore, lost more than $1 billion earlier this year in trading on the Japanese market. The losses forced the sale of the bank. 2 months ago, Leeson was detained at Frankfurt Airport shortly after news of the bank collapse shook the financial world. Since then, he has been kept in detention in a Frankfurt jail. His lawyers say they will fight extradition. A final decision by German authorities and diplomats is expected later this year. I'm Dieter Berger in Frankfurt.
The Clinton administration is still keeping the possibility of trade sanctions open with Japan. U.S. trade officials hope the threat will force Japan to open its markets to more U.S. cars and car parts. Washington is getting frustrated after 2 years of talks that have produced little results. The car market accounted for 60% of the $66 billion trade deficit the United States had with Japan last year. Top trade negotiators from both countries are meeting in Canada today. A judge is expected to soon approve Orange County, California's plan to repay nearly 200 localities and other investors in its failed pools with funds from the county treasury. Orange County went bankrupt last December, largely due to bad investment deals by the former county treasurer. It's still not clear if a deal can be worked out to refinance Orange County's huge debt load. The county owes more than $1 billion to bondholders. Authorities in Allendale, South Carolina, say 55 people were treated or released from a hospital after their Amtrak train derailed today. The South Carolina Highway Patrol says none of the injuries were serious. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I've just finished the book that I was most looking forward to reading this season, and it was every bit as good as I'd hoped. In a couple of minutes, we'll meet the author, Scott Spencer. First, critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of his new novel, Men in Black.
In his stunning 1979 novel, Endless Love, Scott Spencer created one of the most passionately intense sex scenes in Western literature. What Spencer did for sex in 20 pages in that novel, he manages to do for childbirth in just 4 pages in Men in Black. Heavy breathing, screams, curses, oozing bodily fluids. Clearly, Spencer revels in those moments when otherwise rational people surrender themselves to the call of the wild. In Men in Black, however, the loss of control that afflicts the main character, Sam Holland, lasts longer than a few frenzied hours and extends into every area of his life. Sam's marriage, his career, his relationship with his son, even his very sense of identity unravel at a dizzying pace. The triumph of Men in Black is that even as it describes the dissolution of Sam's world, it also finds something absurd about his situation. Gasping and laughing are two physical functions almost impossible to perform simultaneously. But Spencer, who's a master at sustaining strong, mixed emotions, teaches his readers how. When Men in Black begins, Sam, who's a 40-year-old struggling novelist, is just realizing that his latest book is turning into a blockbuster. This news should thrill Sam. After all, he and his wife Olivia have recently moved from Manhattan to upstate New York with their 2 children and bought their first home. But that very day that Sam receives a phone call from his ecstatic agent, his troubled teenaged son, Michael, runs away. Oh, and there's another complication. Sam's latest book is a piece of hack work written under the pseudonym John Retcliffe. Entitled Visitors from Above, it's a rehash of half-baked theories about extraterrestrials, which Sam peppered liberally with exclamation points. Sam regards visitors from above the same way Rosemary regarded her baby. Yet when his publishers offer to protect Sam's serious writing career by hiring an actor to appear as John Retcliffe for interviews, Sam, like Rosemary, clasps his bastard creation to his bosom and gamely carries out his parental duties. While he embarks on a book tour, Olivia stays home and goes mad with worry for Michael. Their marriage disintegrates under the pressure of Olivia's resentment, combined with the crushing weight of Sam's guilt. While Olivia is baffled by Michael's disappearance, Sam isn't. He knows Michael ran off because he found out about an affair Sam had with a young researcher. Few writers rival Spencer in conveying the awful momentum of love gone wrong. Spencer's moving evocations have the shock effect of great poetry. Even small moments merit radiant language. When Olivia shrinks from the unwanted sympathy of a neighbor named Russ, we're told she saw a frightening glimpse of some inner Russ, as tender and repellent as that rim of red children show each other when they yank their eyelids. Early in his ordeal, Sam wakes up with the opening line of the Inferno ringing in his head. Midway in our life's journey, I went astray from the road and awoke to find myself in a dark wood. Like Dante, Sam eventually wends his way back, if not to paradise, then at least to a tolerable purgatory. And like the Divine Comedy, in one respect, Men in Black beautifully renders an experience of suffering, temptation, and love, leavened with profane laughter.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Scott Spencer's new novel, Men in Black. I spoke with Scott Spencer and asked him why he created a character who made a living writing hack books under a pen name.
I think the impetus was really a fact I had come across in a book several years ago, and a book that I allude to inside the novel, a book called Warrant for Genocide by Professor Norman Cohn, in which he discusses the origins of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. And I don't even remember why I was reading that book. Actually, I do. I was house-sitting many, many years ago for the late Bernard Malamud, and I found it in his shelf. And I started reading it, and I became totally engrossed by the fact that the Protocols, which were these pages and pages of genocidal lies, really came from the work of a pseudonymous author who was just a hack, writing page after page and basically being paid by the word. And he wrote whatever popped into his very mediocre mind. And then one day, a part of it, this banal fantasy of a bunch of rabbis meeting in a cemetery and discussing the fate of the European financial and political systems, was excerpted, was taken out of the context of one of his penny dreadful novels and took on a horrible life of its own. And the idea of the power of the word and the power of the written word and the incredible danger of writing down a lie seized my imagination and stayed there for many, many years until I finally got a chance to write Men in Black.
Well, the character in your book ghostwrites a book about UFOs. He's also ghostwritten An Intelligent Woman's Guide to Pro Football, Traveling with Your Pet, and Crystal Death, which is a book about the hazards of table salt. Now, I know you've ghostwritten books, too, although I don't know what. Can you say?
You know I've ghostwritten books?
Yes.
Well, it's true, but I'm surprised that you do know. I did ghostwrite a couple of books, one about a television program and one about animals, and it was done a long time ago before I was lucky enough to begin earning a living as a real writer, and I suppose that experience stayed with me for a long time, and maybe this is my apology for that.
What was the TV show you wrote about?
The TV show I wrote about is not to be mentioned here, because then you would be able to find the book and realize that I had written it.
And you would what, die of shame? Or what would the consequence be if I found the book and read it?
It would be harder for me to forget that I did it. It's you know, when the more people who know about it, the more difficult it becomes for me to deny that I ever did it.
Well, you must have drawn on that experience for this novel.
Well, I drew on the experience of what a dreadful and nasty business it is to just churn out page after page. What didn't happen with this book was I mean, it certainly didn't take off and make all kinds of money. It just came out and went. But there was a tremendous shock once when I was reading the New York Review of Books, which is just, you know, a great august journal, and I saw a reference to one of the books that I had written in this writer's argument about some larger cultural topic, and I felt really, really ashamed, because in fact this television program that I had written about was very, very prominent at the time, but I was living in absolute poverty in the middle of nowhere and didn't even have a television set. So, in fact, I'd never even seen this show, and the fly-by-night publisher sent me synopses of what was on the show on a week-by-week basis. And I kind of read through these and then spun out this 160 pages of garbage about it.
Scott Spencer is my guest, and he has a new novel called Men in Black. Your character in the novel goes on the road to do a book tour, but of course, since he didn't write this book under his own name, he has to go in character as the pseudonym. And he goes to a bookstore, and all the people who show up for his signing are the kind of people who'd like a book about UFOs, but there aren't the kind of people who'd like the literary books he writes or that would even like him. In fact, can I have you read a paragraph?
Sure.
About that?
Okay. Inside the store, there was a large crowd, mostly of the sort of people I was coming to expect. Not for me, the girls in their summer dresses, the sultry women in their black leotards, the grad students with pulsating eyes, the latter-day bohos and berets. No, my readers had casts on their feet, ace bandages on their ankles, patches on their eyes. They received radio signals through the fillings in their teeth. They needed to lose weight, gargle. They had lost their meager inheritance in pyramid schemes. They wouldn't mind selling you mail-order shoes or Amway kitchen cleansers. They rattled around the country on secondary roads where the gas and food were cheaper. They tested their cellars for radon. They called the Culligan man. They watched the Christian Broadcasting System. They looked for stores that still sold 8-track tapes. They lived near electric power line towers the size of the Washington Monument. They had guns. I sat at a table and signed their books, listened to their stories. Sign it to Buster and say, "See you on the other side," one demanded. And, "Do you worry about assassination?" asked another, his mustache twitching, his teeth flashing.
Have you had this kind of alienating experience of going to a signing and finding readers who had nothing in common with you?
No, I haven't, because I've never written a book that, you know, I've never gone on the road with a book that I didn't write and that I didn't care about.
Your book is in part the story of a father who feels like he's totally blown it, and he's a father who isn't sure he ever really wanted to be a father, and he's grown increasingly alienated from his son. And I think, in a way, that story is going against the grain. This is a time when so many male writers have been writing about being the sensitive father, being the father that they felt they never had. And do you know what I mean?
I do. See, I'm sort of saved from that because I actually am a sensitive father, so I don't have to write about being one. And I don't have to write about the father I never had because I have a great father, you know, who's still a huge part of my life. So I understand fatherhood as, in a way, that you understand it when you've actually been given it. I've been given a chance to be a father to two interesting kids, and I've had a chance to have an interesting father. And these two experiences have been so shaping to my life that imagining their absence is very easy for me and very, very fertile for me, too.
I detect a certain cynicism about a lot of the sensitive father books that have been published in the past few years.
Yeah, well, it's not only I can't watch the Academy Awards anymore because I can't watch stand up seeing these guys who probably are home 15 hours a year holding up their Oscar and saying, you know, "This is for you, Jeremy." And,
Is it hard to write this kind of book, though, about alienation between father and son when you have children, out of fear that the children will think it's somehow about you and about them?
Yes, it is. More so when I'm going over the galleys. When I'm really composing the book, once I change a couple of... once the book takes on its own imaginative life, it's so clear to me that these aren't my children I'm talking about, and this really isn't me that I'm talking about, that I can't imagine anybody misconstruing it as autobiographical. But I think I need to feel that when I'm writing. And when I see it in galleys, I say, gee, this is kind of cutting a little close to the reality here. But by that time, it's too late.
Scott Spencer is my guest. His new novel is called Men in Black. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. back with novelist Scott Spencer. I've always admired your facility in writing about sex in fresh ways. And you find ways to write about both the passion and the absurdity of sex. Mm. Well, in Endless Love, you have a really passionate scene that goes on for tens of pages. And one of the things that's very unusual about the scene is that she's menstruating through it. In Preservation Hall, I think it is, there's a scene where there's crumpled tissues in the bedroom that imply that there was sex. I thought, what an interesting telling detail. I believe there was a diaphragm in one of your scenes, but I don't remember for sure.
Right.
But there's a short description that has more to do with the absurdity of sex that, in your new novel that, why don't I ask you to read it?
Okay. They were down to the occasional poke, and even those were corrupted by their singularity. Sex, if it is not regular, becomes a little ludicrous. Your sexuality becomes a special guest star on some long-running sitcom. Your very sex organ becomes some old, safe, vaguely revered has-been, trotted out in a tux on Oscar night to receive his Lifetime Achievement Award.
How did you come up with that? Do you remember what you were thinking when you wrote that?
Of course not.
This is very, very funny. How do you approach writing about sex? And you've approached it from many different ways.
Well, I think that sex is interesting, and it shows something interesting about people, how they feel about it, how they feel during it, how they think about it, how they long for it, how they retreat from it. So to me, it remains a vital subject, really one of the very handfuls of profoundly serious things that a novelist can talk about. So I don't think that it's something that I would require of myself to make sure that there's enough sex in my book. But since there are usually people having relationships in my fiction, it seems just normal and logical and interesting to follow them into the bedroom. I mean, that's partly what fiction is. It's to open the doors that have been closed in our face, and that's certainly a door that's closed in people's faces normally.
Were you ever shy about following your characters into the bedroom?
No. No, not at all. I think that when I began to write about sex, I had the assurance of such incredible privacy since nobody read what I wrote. it didn't seem that revealing at all.
Well, you know, it does interest me that you're able to write about, as I said before, both the passion of sex, the obsession of it, but also the absurdity it can have too. That you see both sides.
Yes, well, it's a conversation between people, and it's you know, to have it just be passionate and wonderful, although it can be that, doesn't seem real. I don't think that would remind people of anything that had ever happened to them.
Do you, when you write a new book, do you ever visit your book in bookstores and check on how it's doing?
I try not to, because I did just a few days ago, and I went into a store near my apartment, and they had a few copies there, and then I came back a couple days later, and there were more copies there, and I thought, are there returns already? Are they just ordering more? So I figured that unless I got into their computer, that this would not be a fruitful way for me to spend my time.
Because you'd always drive yourself crazy.
I just wouldn't be learning anything.
Oh.
I just wouldn't be learning anything. And while I was there, the book is in was on the table near the door, and I was standing there kind of looking at it, and then someone came and picked the book up. And the back jacket of this book has a picture of me. So I became frantic with shyness, and found myself like some kind of deviant, hiding behind the paperbacks, watching this man as he sort of read the flap copy and looked to thumb through the thing, tossed it back on the table, went and bought a cookbook, left. I think I better go home.
So he didn't spot you?
Not as far as I know.
You wrote a piece about Norman Mailer a few years ago when Harlot's Ghost came out.
Right.
And you said about him, you described him as a man whose passionate public life has so often seemed to make your own hermetic writer's life seem rather pallid. Have you ever wished to be a more Mailer-esque kind of writer in the sense that he's made his life into part of his art? He's lived this big life with big gestures and fist fights and running for office and, you know, having big debates at town hall and so on.
Well, I've made a list of the things that you've offered me. And I've checked yes to fist fights, no to debates in town hall, and no to running for office. Now, there is something very admirable and about the way Norman's lived his life. And sometimes my life, which is really very, very ordinary, has to do with, you know, raising my kids and sitting at my table and writing my books, does seem kind of pallid in comparison. But I feel very lucky to be able to have the life I do, to have my kids and to have my profession and to have time to see my friends and play tennis and do a little traveling. So it's not really that I want to toss my life over, but there is, I don't think that anyone could fail to be impressed and a little wowed by all Norman's managed to do.
When you were young, what did you imagine the writer's life was like?
I imagine the writer's life was like sort of like the life that the writers lived in Reds, of walk-ups in Greenwich Village and martinis and love affairs and conversations that went on till 5 in the morning and grand gestures and feeling that the world was waiting eagerly for what you had to say next.
And that's not the writer's life you chose, though.
Well, that's not the writer's life that exists.
Well, that's a good point.
Except again, an O'Hare airport. And if you're up at 5 in the morning because everyone's flight's been canceled.
That's not really the life you ended up wanting, though. That kind of sociable life, I think. You seem more...
No, it's not. It's not the life that I essentially led, because there were so many other things that I wanted too, and I also felt that, I'm not a person of endless capacities, and it would be hard for me to drink a bottle of Wild Turkey and stay up till 5 o'clock in the morning and expect to do anything the next day.
Scott Spencer, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk to you, Terry.
Scott Spencer's new novel is called Men in Black. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Martin Amis's new novel, The Information, is about rivalries within the literary world. Amis has been at the center of controversy ever since word got out that he'd asked for a book advance of £500,000. Coming up, we talk with Martin Amis about rivalry in the book world. And linguist Jeff Nunberg takes Cosmo's grammar quiz. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Senate Labor and Human Resources Committee has opened confirmation hearings on the nomination of Dr. Henry Foster to be Surgeon General. Chairwoman Nancy Kassebaum says Foster should be considered on his whole record and not just on abortion. Dr. Foster, who supports legal abortion and has performed them, says he believes a physician must act in the best interest of his patients.
I have dedicated my career to taking all appropriate medical steps to meet the health needs of my patients, and that includes performing legal abortion. In America, a woman has a right to choose. And I support the president's position, and most Americans, that abortion in this country should be safe, legal, and rare.
Foster has come under withering fire from conservatives who oppose him for performing abortions and for misjudging how many he's performed. The Clinton administration says thousands of Cuban refugees now held at the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base will be allowed into the United States. The White House had once insisted this would never happen. Officials say the new arrangement is part of an agreement with Cuba. The United States is warning any new Cuban refugees will not be allowed to enter the United States and will be returned to Havana. There are more than 21,000 Cuban refugees in Guantanamo, down from about 30,000 last fall. The North Carolina Court of Appeals has ordered new trials for two people convicted in the Little Rascal sexual abuse case. Both worked at the daycare center where prosecutors allege many children were molested. From member station WUNC, Diane Toomey reports.
A three-judge panel unanimously ordered the new trials for Robert Kelly and Dawn Wilson. Both had received life sentences for allegedly sexually abusing children at the Little Rascals Daycare Center that Robert Kelly ran in Edenton, North Carolina. The appeals court cited improper closing arguments as well as improper testimony from parents as justification for the new trials. Daycare owner Robert Kelly's original trial in 1992 was one of the longest and most expensive in the state's history. His wife pleaded no contest to lesser charges and was released from prison after serving her sentence. For National Public Radio, I'm Diane Toomey in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
A study suggests a popular Republican health care reform plan would help healthy workers but hurt ill ones. The American Academy of Actuaries says under a proposed medical savings account, about three-quarters of workers would benefit from a switch from standard coverage to cheaper coverage. Savings would then be earmarked for workers' personal medical accounts, but the rest of the workers would be forced to pay more of their medical bills. Older employees and pregnant women would be among the losers. On Wall Street, the stock market set a new record today. The Dow gained 12 points to close at 43.28. This is NPR. Croatia says its offensive against rebel Serbs is over, and the Serbs have stopped resisting. One report from the United Nations says the Serbs have indeed surrendered, but earlier today, Serbian rockets crashed into Zagreb, the Croatian capital, killing 5 people. More than 120 people were hurt. Despite the announcement of the end of the offensive, air raid sirens sounded again in Zagreb, prompting fears of more Serbian attacks. The fighting in Croatia is the most serious since the civil war ended. Japan is withholding a $542 million loan to Iran after President Clinton's call for a trade embargo. The loan is part of a $1.8 billion credit package Japan promised Iran in 1993. The BBC's Kati Kay reports from Tokyo.
Japan says that it hasn't altogether cancelled this loan to Iran, but has rather postponed it indefinitely. That insistence reveals just how President Clinton's call for an embargo has placed Tokyo in a diplomatic quandary. On the one hand, resource-poor Japan is reluctant to alienate Iran, from whom it buys 10% of its oil imports. On the other, Japan clearly doesn't want to aggravate its major Western ally. In this instance, Tokyo's relationship with Washington was clearly deemed more important. Japan has been accused in the past of not joining embargoes on Middle Eastern countries. This time, it seems, Tokyo didn't want to risk any such accusations, so Japan responded promptly to President Clinton's appeal.
Caddy Kay reporting. The director of the Smithsonian's Air and Space Museum has resigned. Martin Harwood says the continuing controversy over the display of the Enola Gay bomber plane is the reason. The Enola Gay dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima 50 years ago. The large planned exhibit was scrapped after veterans groups complained to the Smithsonian the display made them look like villains and the Japanese like innocent victims. 81 members of the House of Representatives called for Harwood's dismissal in January. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Martin Amis, one of England's most popular and acclaimed writers, has written a new satirical novel about a failed novelist consumed with jealousy over his oldest friend's literary success. The failed novelist, Richard Tull, thinks of his books as modernist genius novels, but even his editors find them unreadable. In fact, most of them are unpublishable. The only way Tull can think of to make his life tolerable again is to ruin the life of his successful friend, Gwyn Barry. In an ironic twist, Martin Amis's success has left him in the center of controversy, mostly surrounding his $800,000 book advance. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan says she hopes Amis is laughing all the way to the bank. After all, he worked 5 years to create a savagely funny novel that also makes readers think seriously about art and immortality. I asked Martin Amis to compare the writing styles of the two main characters in his new novel.
Richard is what one might call a marooned modernist. He follows the path blazed by Joyce. This was a time when we all seemed to like difficult novels. We craved difficulty. Nothing could ever be good unless it was very difficult. It stretched you till you twanged, you know, that was the idea. Whereas in the 19th century, and I think we've reverted to this now, most novelists would say that the art is very much to do with pleasing the reader, not with stretching the reader. Still, pleasing the reader is not what we're meant to think when we contemplate the work of Gwyn Barry. All Gwyn does really is not offend the reader. He writes novels that might have been, you know, patched together to fit an age of political euphemism. There's almost a sort of quota system in his fiction. Every race is represented. There are 6 women, 6 men. Everyone has a non-disfiguring disease so that no one need feel any worse or better than anyone else. It's a kind of even-handed positive discrimination kind of fiction that he writes. And of course, wildly successful in this climate.
There's so much in your new novel about literary jealousy. Actually, let me read a couple of lines. There's a part where Richard Tull is reading reviews of his rival Gwyn Barry's new novel. And Tull thinks, "The reviews, while hardly the pyrotechnic display of sarcasm and contempt for which Richard hoped, had nonetheless been laudably condescending and unanimous and brief. With any luck, Gwyn was finished." Do you think that jealousy comes with the territory when you're a writer? Do you think most writers wish their rivals ill?
I think that's exactly right. I think any writer who tells you different is either putting you on or isn't a serious writer deep down. Gore Vidal has said, it's not enough to succeed, others must fail. And every time something nice happens to a contemporary of mine, Gore Vidal has said, I die a little. I think I put it loosely or poetically when I say that writers have to hate each other or have to be, you know, invidious with regard to one another because they're competing for something there's only one of, which is the universal. You want everyone to be reading you and not wasting their time reading other people. and that's, I've just taken this to an extreme, as I tend to do in my work.
So do bad reviews of others make you feel good?
They put a little spring in my step, but not, you know, not for long. I think, you know, one of the reasons why I wrote this book and what over or under qualifies me to write about writing is that I was born into a house where there already was a writer, my father. And writing for me is completely unexotic because nothing is less exotic than what you see your father doing every day. So I get these little impulses, these vanities, these vicious stabs, and I recognize them and even play with them and run with them for a bit. But they don't actually, you know, they don't really engage me, exercise me. I get a little, you know, high when I see someone getting a bad review and feel a little bit depressed when I see someone getting praised.
Let me get to some of the controversy surrounding your book deal, which has been written about at least as much as the book itself has been. The big story in the press about your book is that you had apparently asked for £500,000 as an advance, which is the equivalent of about $800,000, and that you left your former agent for a new agent, and that agent was the wife of a good friend, the novelist Julian Barnes. She's the one who you left. Let me ask you why you set a fee and asked for that much. A lot of people apparently thought that it was really unseemly for a serious novelist to ask for that big in advance.
Well, I ask you to imagine how weary I am of this whole subject. But to begin with, I didn't demand or stick at this sum. I just suggested it as an opening bid. Where are we? I mean, as you describe this whole controversy, you fail to make it sound very sexy or scandalous to me. That I, you know, what happened was, I changed agents and in midstream, and the agent is married to a friend of mine, who's a novelist. But you know. I haven't chopped anyone up and put them underneath my kitchen floorboards. Does this, in fact, sound to you like a story?
I'm not saying I thought it was the most incredibly amazing revelatory thing I'd heard, but I know it's been covered a lot.
Well, I know, but I think the only, you know, way of looking at this and staying sane is that you take it as a story
right.
about England rather than a story about me, because
right.
you know, the bare bones of the case, you know, don't sound very headline grabbing in American terms, do they?
My guest is Martin Amis, and he's written a new novel called The Information. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with writer Martin Amis, his new novel is called The Information. I want to ask you a little bit about the literary profile and how writers' professional and private lives are dealt with in those profiles. First of all, this figures into your novel, The Information, because the unsuccessful writer is following around the successful writer so he can write a profile of him. And you've both profiled a lot of writers in your own literary career, and you've been the subject of many profiles. In recent profiles, those profiles have been going into your private life and the fact that you left your wife and are with somebody else now, and it's been going into changing the agents and the amount of money you got for your advance and this and that. Do you feel that there's a line that should be drawn in a literary profile between what's personal and what's public? Do you have your own kind of sense of personal ethics?
I certainly have a code, and you know, if a writer I'm profiling says, I don't want you to say anything about this, then I won't. But there's nothing is off the record anymore. I find that, you know, my father also divorced my mother when I was 12, and he was in the papers a good deal. And as I remember, all you had to deal with in those days from the press was a great deal of hypocrisy. Now that's changed, because there's no need for hypocrisy anymore, because everyone's proud of being an unscrupulous bastard. And it's more a kind of manic scurrility now is what you get, where people will just slap anything onto the page, print it, and sit back giggling and hugging themselves with how irresponsible they've been. The impulses you're facing, which are to do with ripping down people that you've exalted, etc., puncturing the vanity and affectation of artistic types, you're always having to deal with that, and jealousy and envy. But the language, the tone changes with time, and it's become, you know, I can tell you, it's become very, very much coarser. I think more in England than here, funnily enough.
More in England than here?
Yeah.
You know, I have to agree with you that things have really gone overboard in the investigation of people's private lives, of public people's private lives. I don't mean elected officials, but, you know, writers and actors and so on. Mm. And as an interviewer myself, I know that I'm kind of a party to some of that, but I always feel like what I'm trying to do is make connections between somebody's life and the work that they've produced that interests us so much. What happened in the life that led to this interesting work?
But I disagree. I don't think there is any connection.
Well, that's what I wanted to know from you. Like, where do you think the legitimate connections lie? Like, when you're profiling somebody, where do you think the legitimate connections lie between a person's life and their art?
Well, I think it's a journalistic convention to make these connections. Mm-hmm. I think they're in fact deeply mysterious. You know, as when I interviewed Saul Bellow, I quoted something he'd written, which he said, you know, why interview me? It's all in the books. Updike has said it too.
It
is kind of all in the books, somewhere in the books, and you get a much more complicated sense of that something in the books. But we live in a culture where, you know, it's much more fun and much easier to get a handle on a personality, quote unquote, than on a corpus of work. But if you look at, you know, look back in literature and read literary biographies, and, you know, halfway through your second one, you'll realize that there, in fact, is no useful connection between the life and the work. And there's certainly no moral connection. You know, writers, on the whole, lead pretty messy lives. This doesn't affect the work. The work is still there. You know, if a writer's life did, by its laxity or its messiness, contaminate the work, then we wouldn't have any literature. It would all have to go.
It's funny you should mention literary biography, because one of the things the main character does in your book is review literary biographies, but they're really kind of second-rate biographies about second-rate writers.
Mm.
Duds about duds.
Yeah.
Is, I think, what he calls it.
Duds on duds.
Yeah. So have you been thinking about this a lot? You know, what kind of literary biography makes sense?
I've never thought any of it made sense. And the first literary biography I ever reviewed, I was 23 or 4 at the time, and I said, well, 21, I said that my opening sentence was, the literary biography is a dead genre. It makes false connections between the work and the life. It imputes to the author a kind of a grand design, you know, a sort of plan. And every writer knows that you never plan anything. You know, you just write the next thing that is given you to write. And that's the end of it. It promotes various fallacies about how writing is done, that it's in response to various events and situations. And it isn't. I think you would write more or less what you were going to write no matter what happened to you in your life. I'm sort of romantically inclined to make a complete distinction between the life and the work.
What makes you then want to sometimes profile other writers?
Well, you want to meet them. Reading someone is like meeting them. when you finished a book you love, don't you find you have an impulse to ring them up?
Oh, sure, but I think that's what lies behind why people want to read profiles, too, is that if you've fallen in love with somebody's work,
yeah,
you want to know, like, well, who is this person?
Yeah.
And you want to be in their presence somehow, and you want to find out more. You're just, like, really curious because you like the work so much.
That's right. But idle and vulgar curiosity is all that it is, really. And to take it further, really, you should read more of their books. But we live in a kind of sort of personalized culture. You know, this is why people love signed copies. This is why people like to meet the author. It's you want a piece of it, and that is why, you know, in some cases writers can stir up a kind of a tabloid fever temporarily, because they either love you or think they own you or want to kill you. I mean, it does get violent because reading is a very intimate activity, and that is a, you really are getting close to a writer when you read him, and it's our literal mindedness perhaps that makes us want to, you know, go and have a drink with him and sit in his lap.
The successful novelist in your novel, The Information, one of his hobbies is imagining how the authorized biography of him is going to read years from now when it's written. Why did you have him imagining that?
Because I do get these stabs of outrageous conceit and vanity, and I do run with them and see where they lead. And I look for the comedy in them, and I just thought, you know, for perhaps one second of one day, I thought that to myself. But I just realized, I thought, I probably am going to have my biography written. And then as I went to get a cup of coffee, I had in my head, you know, often he would go in mid-morning and make a cup of coffee. He preferred Colombian and medium roast, etc. And I thought this is insane and hideous. But then I sort of ran with it for a bit and thought, no, this is very funny and it'll be perfect for my vain novelist character.
Martin Amis, his new novel is called The Information. This is Fresh Air. Two men were arrested today and are being held as material witnesses in the Oklahoma City bombing. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what will you have on that on All Things Considered?
We'll tell you everything we know about Gary Allen Land and Robert Jacks this afternoon. We're covering the story from Washington and from Oklahoma City. Also, Terry, the Attorney General said today that 15,000 Cubans being held at Guantanamo Bay can come into the United States. That is, most of the refugees being detained there. We're following the confirmation hearings of Dr. Henry Foster to be the Surgeon General. We'll have a report on that. The war has resumed in Croatia. We're following that story. And we have a very soft, sweet music piece today.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Grammar quizzes can turn up in the oddest places. Linguist Jeff Nunberg found that out when a friend of his steered him to last month's Cosmo magazine.
Alice has her feminist credentials so squarely in line that she can get away with reading anything. You want to look at Cosmopolitan, she told me. They have a grammar quiz in there. I told her I'd pick it up, asked her what was on the cover. She snorted. It's Cosmopolitan, she said. What do you think is on the cover? I found the quiz anyway in the back of the April issue between a feature on Heather Locklear and an ad for an exercise video called Buns of Steel. How good is your grammar, it said. That pretty little mouth of yours may not always say the correct thing. I figured it was going to be one of those dress for success kinds of things, but most of the sentences in the test had nothing to do with the language that Cosmopolitan girl might use when she goes for a job interview. They were written in that sassy dialect that Cosmo likes to imagine its readers use with each other when they're touching up their blush in the ladies' room. Can you spot the grammatical errors in the following? Between you and I think Marcy and John are sleeping together. The madness of the affair, furtive kisses, secret phone calls, weekend getaways, are what really appealed to her. I can swing the Todd Oldham dress if my mother loans me the money. Any chance of him meeting us? after the Pearl Jam concert? I'm going to St. Kitts. Which bikini do you think I should bring with me? Actually, I missed that one, since I've always been a little fuzzy on the bring-take business. I thought the problem was that Cosmo uses bikini as a plural. The whole quiz had the lubricious tone of every other feature in the magazine. I half expected to come to the end and find something like, add up your score. If you got more than 12, you are multi-orgasmic. It's a curious incongruity. I mean, you think about grammar, you think of a gray, neutered place with two stone lions at its gates, one of them a fifth-grade schoolmarm, and the other some old curmudgeon like William Sapphire or Edwin Newman. The country of grammar is the North Korea of language, with avenues lined with neoclassical facades and all the televisions locked on McNeil Lehrer and C-SPAN. It isn't a place I ordinarily think of that cosmopolitan girl as hanging out in. I think of her as someone who uses like as a conjunction, says ain't when she feels like it, and swears while she's trying to light up in a convertible. Still, why shouldn't she indulge in a little correct grammar now and then? A nice touch, like linguistic lip liner. I can hear the magazine now. Just the thing to keep him interested. That pretty little mouth of yours drawn in a pout as it closes around a whom. That coy overture when he calls you from a payphone. My roommates are all at the beach. There's no one here but little old I. Indeed, why not? After all, grammar's gotten to be a pretty dreary business. We seem to have lost sight of the fact that the word grammar is related to glamour via an old Scottish word that means sorcery. Maybe that's just the fate that grammar deserves, is to become so arcane and retro that it starts to sound kinky. It seems unnatural for a decade that's seen the revival of the wonder bra and the corset, a hint of uplift, a soupçon of constraint. Now there's an MTV video for the 90s, Madonna in A Merry Widow singing I Am a Grammatical Girl. And thank goodness we still have Helen Gurley Brown around to write a sequel to her 60s bestseller. This time she can call it Sex and the Singular Verb.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Bentham, Richard Parker, and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Jerry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Crown, publisher of a new Katharine Hepburn biography by Barbara Leeming. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Can-Do Capitalism in the Age of Crack. William Adler, author of Land of Opportunity, chronicles the rise and fall of a Detroit crack empire. Also, we'll hear from one of the creators of the new TV series, VR5. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.